Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Happy Tuesday morning, and thanks for listening to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix with Lauren Gilger. I'm Steve Goldstein. Coming up later on this hour, we'll hear about efforts to imprison fewer Americans. It's a bipartisan effort. Plus, one of the original copies of a historic 19th century treaty is back in the hands of the Navajo Nation. And we want to let you know that this summer, from Memorial Day to Labor Day, the show is going to be focusing more on local and regional coverage with a one-hour program starting at 9. We still want your ideas, though. Email us at the show at kjzz.org.
We begin this morning's show with news about Arizona's water future. I don't know about you, Steve, but I don't remember a time in this state when we have not been in a drought.
Lauren, I'm much older than you, and I do not either, and it's just this dry desert. That's what we're used to.
It's a desert, right. Okay. But for the first time in its 20-year history, the U.S. Drought Monitor now is saying that Arizona is no longer under drought conditions. That's being credited to the unusually wet May we just experienced. It was beautiful. And here to tell us more about what this means is Matt Pace, a meteorologist with the Arizona Department of Environmental Quality. Good morning, Matt.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. So I assume I have to start with the before we get too excited question. What does this mean?
You always start with that one, of course. So it does mean, obviously, we had a very wet May. Unfortunately, and here's the sad part, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to be wet for the next couple months. In fact, we are moving into our driest period of June here in Phoenix. We generally only seen about 0.02 inches of rain, which is basically just a couple sprinkles. But it is looking like the monsoon will be a little bit delayed, but it could be fairly active as we head into July and August. So we'll keep our fingers crossed that we can keep this precipitation going and have a continued wet July and August.
Matt, I think what's funny about the whole drought situation, when we hear that term, we're told often, I presume we've heard it from you, and it makes total sense for meteorologists or climatologists to say, you know, one wet winter or one wet May, unseasonably wet May, isn't going to make a difference. So without getting too deep in the weeds, can you explain to us how this works, like how we're out of drought to some extent when we've had it for almost 2 decades? And yeah, it was wetter than normal, but it didn't seem amazingly wet.
Yeah, exactly. Drought is a longer-term process. You have to think about things slowly drying out. You think about the lakes slowly going down in their water level. Even the smaller lakes that aren't necessarily dammed up, but just kind of the tanks that are around, especially up in northern Arizona, those take time to dry out, and that soil takes time to dry out. And that's when you start seeing that drought come back. And just like when you have a lot of rain, after it's been dry for so long, a lot of that will just seep straight into the ground or run off, and it doesn't really help any of the soils, any of the plants across the state. So it takes a long time for these cycles to kind of come on and turn off. And that's why you don't see an instantaneous reduction in the drought just because we had one wet May. We had a pretty wet year this year around the entire state. So that's why now we're starting to see those drought classifications removed from Arizona.
So short-term drought as opposed to long-term drought. We're still in that long-term drought.
Exactly. Yeah. And that can take years to kind of get out of, because, again, it's a cyclical pattern that happens, you know, a period of 20, 30, 40 years. So 1 year is not necessarily going to make that huge difference.
OK, not going to make a huge difference, but it does make some difference, right? Like, what does this do in a good way? I know there are also concerns this brings up about greenery created that will make a harder wildfire season this summer. But there has to be some positives here, too, right?
Oh, there's certainly some good things that happen. I mean, when you look at our SRP reservoirs up to the north, they're at 80% capacity right now. Last year, they were only at 55%. So that's a drastic improvement from what we saw. Obviously, the temperatures, this weather pattern that we've seen of these low pressure centers coming through, it's kept our temperatures very cool. We've only had 200 degree days. That's the least we've seen since 1998. And even our air quality here in Phoenix has been pretty good over the past couple months. We've only had 3 ozone exceedances. That's the least that we've seen since 1982. So certainly a lot of positive stuff come out of this more active weather pattern that we've seen.
Okay, so looking forward, it is now officially summer and monsoon season will start soon enough. Any predictions on what that might look like and if we are going to continue seeing more rain than usual?
Hopefully, we'll start to see more rain coming into July. Here in Phoenix, it looks like we're going to stay probably pretty dry as we head into June. Again, it's our driest month. But yeah, when you look at the longer range forecast models, it is starting to look like July and August will be a little more active than we normally see. So fingers crossed for that. Unfortunately, we have to say it, the heat is going to return. We'll probably see 110 again by the end of June, sadly.
All right. Well, this is where we live. That's Matt Pace, a meteorologist with the Arizona Department of Environmental Quality. Matt, thanks as always.
Thank you.
We're coming to the end of high school graduation season here in Arizona. Over the last 5 years, an average of 61,000 students have received their diplomas in 4 years around the state. Close to 5,000 of those students had a disability. KJZZ's Mariana Dale has been learning more about the challenges these students face.
Hello, and that's right, Steve. The path these students take to get to that graduation stage might be a little different. They often have what's called an IEP. That's an individualized education program. But there is a baseline for all students in Arizona to earn a diploma, and that's that they have to earn a combination of 22 school credits.
And we're talking about classes like English and math, science, history, and fine arts.
That's exactly right. But the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act says these students should also receive help transitioning to life after high school. That could mean anything from teaching these students how to access special services in college, showing them how to eat properly in a restaurant or rent an apartment. Students with disabilities can also be entitled to attend a public school and receive services until they're 22 years old.
Okay, so this is a really interesting issue, but what put it on your radar specifically?
A few things. The Arizona Department of Education released a draft of new guidance for students with disabilities in regards to graduation earlier this year. It's basically an 8-page, question and answer about the topic. And I've started to hear from attorneys who specialize in helping students with disabilities that there are some problems in this guidance. For example, they say that the Q&A makes it sound like any student with a disability can earn a regular high school diploma just if they meet those guidelines from the state, those 22 credits we talked about. The Arizona Center for Disability Law, where Amanda Glass is an attorney, says a student's individualized education plan can set special requirements for their graduation according to Arizona law.
That provision seems to state that students with disabilities, the requirements for them to graduate can be changed, and it's an individualized decision as to whether or not they should graduate.
Glass is worried that if the guidance doesn't do a good job of explaining this extremely nuanced and complex topic that is special education law, educators and parents aren't going to have the right tools to figure out when a child with disabilities should graduate, if at all.
Okay, so it seems like every word in this guidance is being scrutinized. Can we zoom out for a second and talk about the challenges that families are encountering during graduation season?
Yes, this is a very busy time of year, I've heard, for Glass and other attorneys that help the parents of children with disabilities get the right education. Most often, parents are calling in with two main issues related to graduation, and it actually is funny because they come from different ends of the spectrum. One is that a student might never get to graduate with a diploma, and the other is that they might be being graduated too quickly.
It's a fine line between a student with a disability who is given the opportunity to earn a diploma by being provided appropriate accommodations and modifications, and a student who's being forced to graduate when they haven't achieved the requirements to earn that diploma and is therefore being cut off from services prematurely.
Services that might help young adults with disabilities be successful in the real world, and that's whatever it looks like for them.
So when are we going to get this clearer information on the graduation requirements for students with disabilities?
I asked that very question of the Arizona Department of Education. They don't have a set timeline, and they're still gathering feedback on that draft guidance.
Okay, so what's the next step for you and your reporting?
Well, I'm still gathering string, or rather facts and interviews. So now it's time for a call out. If you have a child with disabilities and have had challenges related to high school graduation, I'd love to talk to you about what your experience has been. You can go to KJZZ's website and find out how to email me or call me on the staff page. And I'm also on all of those different social medias.
KJZZ's Mariana Dale, thanks as always for your reporting.
You're welcome.
The Trump administration's efforts to end the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA, program will have to wait a little longer for its day in court. Yesterday, the Supreme Court declined a request by the Department of Justice to consider whether it would take up the case by the end of the month. The program gives legal status to many Dreamers, those who were brought to the U.S. illegally as children. This order does not close off the possibility that the Supreme Court will take up one of the cases regarding DACA next session, though, and it's just the latest in an ongoing back and forth over the program since the Trump administration announced it would phase it out in 2017. So where does this leave the roughly 800,000 DACA recipients in the country? For more on that, I sat down with Jose Patino, a DACA recipient and the advocacy and policy director for immigrant rights group Aliento. We began our conversation with his story. Patino was brought here with his family when he was just 6 years old, and he says he always knew he was undocumented.
It was my uncle's family and our family living in a two-bedroom apartment, and it was the six of us in just one room, and they wouldn't allow us to go outside without parents or an adult. So I always knew that I was undocumented because they always told me, like, watch out for the migra or immigration. So I always knew, but up until I got into sort of high school, I didn't understand the limitations because we could drive, you could work. But once I started to see, like, hey, you needed to apply for college, and then they started to ask for the Social Security number, that's when it really hit me.
Right.
And when I started getting, I got pulled over, and I was like, that's when it really hit me, like, whoa, I'm undocumented.
So I wonder, when did you get involved in sort of advocacy around this issue? Did it take you having some of those experiences and realizing the limitations placed on you because of this?
Well, I got involved after Prop 300 passed 2006, which is the proposition that denies in-state tuition and access to scholarships for undocumented students. I was a senior in high school. I had applied for ASU, got a full ride, provost scholarship, and my mom was really proud that I was going to be the first one in the family. I'm the youngest of four to go to a university. So then they sent me a letter, hey, like, you're not eligible. And several of our classmates, I got the same letter. So then that's when we started to find out about the Dream Act, getting more involved in outside organizations, and also marching, participating in protests and rallies and anything that we could do. Because at that time, we're just thinking of pursuing our education just because it became sort of a dream of not only me, but also my family, where I basically represented the culmination of their sacrifices. Mm-hmm. I was just determined to get there. And that's how I got involved.
So you've been doing this work for quite some time then, and it's, I would imagine, frustrating at times. So you see the Trump administration rescind DACA. You see the courts put an injunction on that decision. Now it's headed to the Supreme Court at some point. What's it been like, this sort of extended limbo, I guess, that you're in as a DACA recipient in this country?
It's high levels of anxiety and stress. I try to block it out as much as I can in terms of, like, try to live my daily life and the work that I do with the organization that I work with Aliento. But it's always on the news. So it's hard to plan your life, like, to your plan, because that always exists that, hey, this is going to end. So it's really nerve-wracking. I was just actually thinking about it when I was driving mm-hmm. here, and I was like, what happens with my car? What happens with my house? What happens with my employment if ultimately gets rescinded? And in my belief, I think that ultimately the Supreme Court is going to rescind and end the DACA program. They're going to side with the Trump administration. And it's going to leave us with a year or so between the next election. So I think that's our moment for us to sort of engage more politically and change the narrative so we can get a permanent solution. I've been trying to get a permanent solution since I was in high school.
So you do think the Supreme Court's going to end DACA?
Yeah, I just have this feeling that how it's stacked and the arguments they're making, they're going to end it on the basis that the president has the power to end the program, similar to how President Obama had the power and the justification to start it. Not the way that they're sort of saying that it was unlawful or constitutional, but then they're going to make the argument that the president ended it because he had the power.
But it sounds like you see that as an opportunity to push for a permanent solution, like you say. So would that look something like the Dream Act?
Yeah, that is the hope, to get something like the Dream Act. However, in the past, I have seen that if we don't push and organize to galvanize together, we will ultimately end up with nothing. I saw that in 2010. I got involved with the Dream Act. I saw that also with the immigration reform in 2013, and most recently in 2018, when DACA was originally rescinded. So I'm hopeful that we can galvanize and get together, but I'm also understanding and cognizant of the past, how things have ultimately failed.
Mm-hmm. What's the mood of the community in general? You work with undocumented people, you work with mixed status families. When you talk to people like you who are DACA recipients or dreamers, and this continues to go back and forth, and you get a piece of good news and then you get a piece of bad news, I mean, how does the community in general deal with that?
Well, there's sort of like three levels. The undocumented population feels forgotten. So a lot of the students that we work with are undocumented because the DACA program ended before they could apply.
Yeah.
So they feel like they're being forgotten. Our DACA recipients are high-level anxieties. Is the dream going to pass? Oh, is it going to end? So there's always this sort of anxiety, what am I going to do? And the parents are just sort of in desperation mode. It's like, I don't care what happens to me so long as my children are taken care of. Tell me, what do I need to do? Mm-hmm. And then the children are like, no, so long as my parents are taken care of, I don't care what happens to me. So it's sort of like this, it's like a game and we're pawns in it, mm-hmm. and we have no control over it. And it's really frustrating because anything that you do, it feels like it's not enough.
Mm-hmm. I've heard that said before by another DACA recipient, that you are always a pawn in the political game and whichever party wants to use you for their advancement at that moment will. But there's broad support for something like the DREAM Act in polls. It's pretty bipartisan, but it's failed to get through. I wonder, as you look at your advocacy work and as you look forward, what do you think you can do at this point?
Well, I think, and I've heard this from senators and also representatives, they always say that we're not enough, that we're not big enough, that the dreaming population, what we bring to the table, we're not big enough to merit it by itself, that we need to be attached to something else, either comprehensive immigration reform or to a budget, that by itself, the DREAM Act will not pass because there's not enough to go around to satisfy all the other factions that exist in Congress. So the only way that I can think of is how do we actually galvanize and show up that power and build allies. Because we need allies. We can't do it by ourselves. They always tell us, well, you can't vote. So regardless of whatever happens, we're not able to vote. And we cannot contribute financially to a lot of campaigns more than $20 because then that would be considered a foreign entity meddling. So it's always like we need to get our friends who are citizens and residents to come and stand with us. So they were taken seriously by both parties. For the longest time, the Democratic Party didn't take it seriously. Right now, the Republican Party doesn't take it seriously. So for us, it's like we need to ultimately organize ourselves and get those allies who are going to help us.
Jose Patino is a DACA recipient and the Advocacy and Policy Director for Aliento. Jose, thank you for coming in.
Thank you, Lauren.
President Trump's visit to Great Britain continues today. His time Monday was mostly spent with members of the royal family, while today is a bit more focused on politics and policy. Protesters are making their presence known, but the president says he didn't pay much attention to them.
We left the prime minister, the queen, the royal family. There were thousands of people on the streets cheering. And even coming over today, there were thousands of people cheering. And then I heard that there were protests. I said, where are the protests? I don't see any protests. I did see a small protest today when I came, very small. So a lot of it is fake news, I hate to say.
And now we turn to BBC correspondent Rich Preston for more. Rich, I can hear some activity coming up behind you. Clearly, President Trump has generated a tremendous amount of interest. Can you describe the scene where you are?
Yes, Steve, huge amount of interest. I'm in Parliament Square at the moment, so I'm looking at Big Ben as I talk and the Palace of Westminster. And there's a big crowd in front of me who've gathered here over the past few hours. They're protesting against President Trump being here in the UK. Now, Mr. Trump arrived yesterday, and that was really the big royal day when he had his state banquet. A couple of mini demonstrations outside Buckingham Palace then. But today's all been about the politics. So this is really when people have taken to the streets, and they gathered earlier on this morning in Trafalgar Square and made their way down to Parliament Square, where they are now, carrying a range of banners and placards, dump Trump, people against Trump, get Trump out, Trump not welcome, etc., etc. So a very strong and clear message from the crowd here.
Rich, I suppose one could make an educated guess, but what are the protesters especially upset about when it comes to President Trump?
Well, there's a couple of key things. One is climate change. That's an issue that many people in the UK feel very strongly about, and it didn't go down too well when President Trump pull the United States out of the Paris climate deal. So lots of people here waving banners on that topic. There's also people when it comes to nuclear weapons and saying they don't want a nuclear war. They're kind of referring to ongoing tensions with the likes of Iran at the moment. And also people talking about border walls and, you know, we should be building a wall here in the UK to keep President Trump out. Now, it's worth adding, there are a couple of groups here pro-President Trump. Their numbers aren't as great as those protesting against Mr. Trump's visit, and they've been met with a bit of a fierce opposition from the anti-Trump crowds here. But there are a few people gathered on the sidelines saying they're happy Mr. Trump's here and that he's a friend of the UK's.
Now, certainly there's been a tremendous amount of attention paid to Brexit, and earlier today there was a press conference of sorts. President Trump was joined by UK Prime Minister Theresa May. Did any news come out of that?
Nothing solid other than statements about the fact that UK and the US generally want to work together. Now, the UK is still in the middle of its Brexit negotiations, so it's tough for it to actually get into formal agreements with the United States. However, President Trump said he's confident we can reach a, quote, phenomenal trade deal. He talked about the $1 trillion worth of trade that's done between the UK and the US and said that once the UK has left the European Union, that can be 2, maybe even 3 times better. A phenomenal trade deal is on the horizon, he said.
Rich, you mentioned that yesterday was sort of a royal day for President Trump. What's on the agenda primarily today?
Well, on the agenda for today is President Trump has had his breakfast meetings with Theresa May and business leaders. He's also enjoyed a tour of the cabinet war rooms. Those are the war rooms that Winston Churchill and President Roosevelt got together to discuss the likes of the D-Day landings in. And then this evening he has another banquet. This time it's not Buckingham Palace, it's at Winfield House. That's the residence of Woody Johnson, the US ambassador in the United Kingdom. So President Trump's going to be there, and representing the royal family will be Prince Charles and his wife Camilla. And that's interesting because it brings us back to climate. Prince Charles is a strong environmental advocate, and he's hinted that he will bring up the topic of climate change with President Trump and do what he can to impress some opinions on him.
Everidge, finally, you mentioned Woody Johnson, obviously no relation to Boris Johnson, but has there been any talk about that? Boris Johnson, of course, on our shores is considered to be something of a character. Is he expected to meet with President Trump?
Well, to be honest, Steve, we actually just don't know. Now, you listeners may be aware that before his visit, President Trump gave an interview to the Sun newspaper in which he gave his support for Boris Johnson as Theresa May's successor. She steps down as Prime Minister shortly. So somewhat an unprecedented move there for a US president to give his support to a UK politician, give him their backing. He said he wants to meet Boris Johnson while he's in the UK, but nothing's actually been confirmed. However, in Mr. Trump's schedule, there is a period of, quote, executive time, which has been blocked off. So it's entirely feasible in one of those windows. That's when Mr. Trump might meet his, quote, good friend, Boris Johnson.
And that is BBC correspondent Rich Preston joining us, as you can hear, from protests in London, where President Trump is visiting. Rich, thank you, as always, for your time.
Good to talk to you, Steve.
Mass incarceration in the U.S. is an increasingly growing concern among policymakers on both sides of the aisle. The U.S. has 5% of the world's population, but 25% of its prisoners. There are a number of reforms being discussed, some dramatic, others more based on common sense. A recent publication put together by the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University includes a broad swath of possible changes, with ideas from Democratic presidential candidates like Kamala Harris and Elizabeth Warren to President Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner. It's titled Ending Mass Incarceration, Ideas from Today's Leaders. One of the publication's editors and contributors is Enamai Chettiar, director of the Brennan Center's Justice Program, and she is with me. Enamai, even as there is bipartisan support for reforming how the U.S. incarcerates people, what are the major factors that continue to have the nation in this position?
Yeah, so a couple things. So one, I think that it is a misunderstanding that putting more and more people in prison is going to drive down crime. So I think that's a myth that people now understand is actually not true. There's been decades of research showing that that's not the case. Number two, I would say there are some people who are still afraid to be called soft on crime, to kind of take the steps forward to be able to do this. What's fortunate, though, is that public polling has actually shown that a lot of people are for alternatives to prison, and that this is something that the public broadly agrees on, and politicians are also starting to agree on.
So what are some key ways to dramatically reduce the incarcerated population? A lot of people will talk about drug crimes. Other people will talk about people of color getting, frankly, more fair justice.
Yeah. So one of the major factors in the crisis of mass incarceration, as you mentioned, is also the racial justice impact. So that the communities of color bear the brunt of these policies in terms of policing and prosecution and are, end up disproportionately in prison. So in terms of the solutions, so the Brennan Center has actually put forward a plan to cut the prison population by 40% safely. And in order to do that, one thing would be to outright eliminate the use of prison for lower level crimes. And secondly, to reduce the amount of the length of prison sentences for more serious crimes. So even if you think someone should go to prison because they committed a serious crime, they often don't need to be there for 15, 20 years. They can be there for a lot shorter and it would still be effective. So in terms of other solutions, obviously reforming policing is one big one. And police often tend to over-enforce crimes in communities of color. And so I think rebalancing the system of policing is a second factor, as well as reforming prosecutorial practices that also can be racially disparate. So I'd say number one, the sentencing, and number two, focusing on kind of the influx of people coming into prison.
Departments are so different across the country. Are there certain best practices that could potentially be put into effect?
Yes. So one thing that we have found is that community policing, which is where the police join with communities to solve crime together, as opposed to the traditional model of having it be police against, you know, kind of against citizens, to have the police working with citizens, can actually reduce crime and improve relationships with communities, which will often lead to better outcomes.
What is that momentum for bipartisan reform, and how does one get there? Does that have to start from the U.S. Department of Justice? Can it be done on a state-by-state basis?
Yeah, so there are many ways to attack this problem. So one is state by state. So for the last 10 years, states, interestingly enough, starting with Texas, undertook bipartisan efforts to reduce their prison populations. So there is a tremendous amount of momentum in the states. And actually, as these states, you know, Texas, Georgia, New York, Kentucky, all sorts of different states started undertaking these reforms, that's actually how the bipartisan movement then more recently arrived in Washington. And so one of the things we're hoping is that this federal bill that President Trump just signed into law late last year will actually further increase momentum in the states. So I think it is a combined effort of things happening in Washington as well as things happening at the state level.
And you mentioned before there are still those who want to appear tough on crime, and former Attorney General Jeff Sessions was one of them. Is there that feeling, though, as there is more movement for reform, those who don't want reform sort of dig their heels in deeper? And does that create a harder battle, frankly, and a battle that that indicates that people who are really committed have to really be committed?
You know, it's interesting. I think that there is a very small vocal minority against reform, including people like Jeff Sessions and Tom Cotton, but that the majority of the Republican Party, including the president himself, have come to realize the need for criminal justice reform. So I think that, yes, you will always have extremist people on both sides saying different things, but at this point, it is the bipartisan consensus to reduce mass incarceration.
You know, Maya, this is a really loaded question, but what are the greater benefits to society if we limit this mass incarceration, if we do better as a group in terms of fairness?
A couple of things to start with. So one, it's actually shown that prison can often be counterproductive for bringing down crime. So frequently sending people to prison who don't need to be there or sending them to prison for too long can actually increase the likelihood that they will commit crimes upon release of release out of prison due to trouble reintegrating into society. So I think, one, it actually is going to help with keeping people safe by only keeping the most serious offenders in prison. It is going to also have an increase in the effect on our economy. So there are a lot of people who can't get jobs, who are unemployed, who are underemployed because they have a criminal record. So approximately 70 to 100 million people in the U.S. have some kind of criminal record. That is a lot of people. And those people are often stigmatized out of jobs, out of the ability to care for their families, and then frequently actually get pushed back into crime for that reason. So I actually think not only will it promote more employment, it will also promote more safety as well. And then I would just say the moral and racial justice implications. So at this time, approximately 1 in 3 Black men can expect to spend time behind bars in their lifetime. And that is kind of an outrageous number. And so the idea of actually really bringing racial justice and racial equality to the United States, you can't do that without ending mass incarceration.
That is Enamai Chediar. She is with the Brennan Center for Justice. She is the director of its justice program. We've been talking about the publication Ending Mass Incarceration, Ideas from Today's Leaders. Enamai, thank you for the time today.
Thank you.
Good morning. This is the show on KJZZ with Lauren Gilger in Phoenix. I'm Steve Goldstein. We're doing things a bit differently this summer from 9 until 10, from now until Labor Day. We're focusing on the stories of our state and region. The Takeaway is coming up at 10 until 11 as we're following this summer schedule. And please continue to send us your great story ideas. Emphasis on great, please. The show at KJZZ.org.
An original copy of the Treaty of 1868 now belongs to the Navajo Nation. This is the treaty that established the tribe's sovereignty in the eyes of the federal government, and it also ended the Long Walk, a forced march and relocation of thousands of Navajo to eastern New Mexico. Originally thought lost, this copy was found in the documents of one of the original negotiators, Indian Peace Commissioner Samuel F. Tappan. His great-grandniece, Claire Kitty Weaver, had known about the document for years, but didn't really know what she had. Then last year, the Navajo Nation recognized the 150th commemoration of the signing of the treaty and brought another copy of it from the National Archives to their museum to put on display, and Weaver was there. Manuelito Wheeler is the director of the Navajo Nation Museum. I spoke with him more about what it means for his people to own the treaty now and what he told Kitty Weaver when he went to visit her and convinced her to give it to the Navajo Nation.
Well, it wasn't my objective to get down there and convince her. I just wanted to meet her and let her know that this is something that was very special to Navajo people, and also that we were more than capable of caring for a historic document like this for the rest of its life, basically.
So explain that for us. Why is it so important to the Navajo people to have this?
When we had the 150th commemoration last year, a lot of different emotions surfaced. And that's good. That's part of our overall Navajo psyche to go through in order for us to figure out how we should feel about something like this. Mm-hmm. Because for some people, you know, absolutely, it was recognizing a time of terror for our people. And for other people, it marked our strength and our resiliency to come back from something like that.
And remind us what the history was of this. This came at such an important, but like you're alluding to here, a really difficult time in the history of your people.
Right. So in 1864, Navajo people were forced off of our homelands by the United States government, and we were sent on what we refer to as the Long Walk. Mm-hmm. And we were sent to Fort Sumner, New Mexico, which was over 400 miles away. And during that time, it was meant to be either a stopping point on our way to Oklahoma or Florida to settle on reservations that the U.S. was creating for multiple Indian tribes, or it would have been a permanent reservation for us. But when we got there, it was just chaos, and the land was not suitable for farming, and there was nothing in terms of things to hunt. And it was just such a chaotic and horrific time. Navajo people were starving. Navajo people were dying. So it was just a terrible time for us.
But the treaty marks a return to your homeland, right?
Mm-hmm. So then the U.S. government realizes this is going terribly wrong and we need to do something about it. So at that time, our Navajo leaders, you know, we wanted to go back. And that's when the treaty negotiations started to happen. And they came to an agreement and the treaty was signed in 1868. And that marked our returning to our homeland.
So the mixed reactions from people, that doesn't, it sound like, deter you from wanting to have this document in the tribe's possession, right? Do you think that
Absolutely
that's an important
not.
Process?
Yes. It was a process to go through it, but without hesitation, it is something that we need to have here as part of our history. So I keep referring to last year because last year it was stressful, you know, it was stressful on a professional level, on a professional museum level, to make sure the standards of the National Archives were met. And we're a tribal museum and we have 100% Native employees. And so it was about self-determination for me and my staff at that point to make this happen. Mm-hmm. And we did. But it was also stressful on a spiritual level. It was stressful on a psychological level because all of that discussion about its return started to happen. And the Navajo Nation Museum was right in the middle of it.
So what does it mean to you then, as the director of this museum, to have this second copy of this treaty in your possession, in the possession of the museum and of the Navajo people now forever?
I mean, it's mind-blowing for me. It just represents an object that represents our sovereignty with the U.S. government. That's for me personally. For other people, it has spiritual meanings, and it does have spiritual meaning for me as well. But it's ultimately, for me as a museum director, it's my responsibility and the museum's responsibility to have this object to put out there so that our Navajo people can think for themselves and make their own deductions as to what it means, what it meant for us in the past, what it means for us right now, and what does it mean for us in the future.
One final question for you, Manny. There's been a lot of reporting about the loss of the Navajo language, mm-hmm. And of the next generation not being able to speak that. I wonder mm-hmm. if this is encouraging to you, not about the language necessarily, but in terms of keeping the next generation and the next generation of Navajo children after that in touch with that history.
Absolutely. You know, I imagine, like, what would the people who signed and agreed to this treaty, what would they think about us right now? And I don't say that disparagingly, actually. I think it's more along the lines of, like, they would absolutely understand the situations that they were in, that we've been put in, and understand. And they would be encouraged that we're here, we're growing, we're making progress. But in terms of our language, it ain't over yet. And there are dynamic things happening for the Navajo people that can stem the tide and ultimately reverse that language loss to where we will start speaking our language again.
Manny Wheeler is the director of the Navajo Nation Museum. Manny, thank you so much for telling us about this.
Absolutely.
Navajo code talker William Tully Brown died yesterday. He was 96 years old, and he was the third code talker to pass just in the last month. Now there are just 5 known code talkers living. Their story of using the Navajo language as code during World War II has been celebrated in recent years and stands in stark contrast to reports of the rapid loss of the Navajo language today we mentioned there. For more on these last code talkers, we're joined now by KJZZ's Laurel Morales with our Fronteras desk in Flagstaff. Good morning, Laurel.
Hi, Lauren.
So tell us a little bit about these 3 code talkers who passed this month.
Well, all 3 were in their 90s, so they had lived a long life. Fleming Begay died May 10th. Begay had fought in several battles during World War II, including Saipan, where he was shot and badly wounded. He spent a year in a naval hospital in California recovering and still lived to be 97. And then a couple weeks later, former New Mexico Senator John Pinto died. He served 42 years in the state legislature, a record for that state. And he represented a region that includes the Navajo Nation, considered one of the poorest in the country. Pinto said he entered politics to address that poverty. Mm-hmm. A funny story was told by Senate President Manny Aragon, who was driving to the state house in January of 1977. It was a snowstorm, and he picked up a middle-aged Navajo man who was hitchhiking in Albuquerque, and that hitchhiker turned out to be newly elected Senator Pinto. And then yesterday, William Tully Brown passed, and he served from 1944 to 1946 for the Marines as a code talker at both Guadalcanal and Iwo Jima. And he was considered a humble man who did not seek recognition, but the world now knows of his great contribution.
Yeah. So as we mentioned, there are just 5 Navajo code talkers left living. What's their legacy as they all sort of reach their late 90s here?
Yeah, so today we honor the Navajo code talkers because they developed this code that was so unbreakable, so efficient that it was critical in ending World War II and wound up saving many lives as a result. There were 29 original code talkers that developed the actual code, which wound up being more than 600 words, I believe. All of the original code talkers have passed. And so after the first 29 developed the code and they saw that it was working and working really well, the Marines recruited more than 400 Navajos to execute it. And so and code talker Peter McDonald tells me that people thank him all the time for saving their grandfather's life and for effectively putting a stop to the deadliest war in history. The idea for the code wasn't born until after the attack on Pearl Harbor in 1942. So had it been sooner, who knows how many more lives it could have saved. The code talkers had to keep it a secret for decades because it was such a efficient and it worked so well, the Marines thought they might use it again. So the code talkers weren't actually celebrated until the late 60s.
All right. That's KJZZ's Laurel Morales with our Fronteras desk in Flagstaff talking about the Navajo code talkers, the 3rd of whom died just this month. Laurel, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Fans of mid-century modern buildings are getting excited about an adaptive reuse project on West Camelback Road as it gets closer to completion. KJZZ's Christina Estes is here to talk with us more about the project. Good morning, Christina.
Good morning.
Okay, so this isn't just about the mid-century architecture. It's also about the location, right?
Right. The location is nearly as much a story as the project itself. We're talking about 2 buildings on Camelback Road at 4th Avenue along the light rail line. The key players are Venue Projects and Vintage Partners. They're the ones behind the development of Uptown Plaza at Camelback and Central Avenue. Some people who live and work west of Central Avenue, they're especially excited because they've been saying, hey, what about us? In the last 5 years or so, they've seen a lot of restaurants and retail cluster along 16th Street and 7th Street. And of course, there's been intense development downtown along light rail. So they're hopeful this project will lead more developers to look west of Central Avenue.
Okay, so let's talk about the project underway. So this is at Camelback and 4th Avenue. The site has two buildings that were built in the early 1950s. Are they both staying?
Yes, both will be used for a boutique hotel called Arrive. The buildings are referred to as 400 and 444 based on their addresses. During a forum hosted by Valley Partnership last month, Lorenzo Perez with Venue Project said they want to get both buildings on the National Register of Historic Places.
And they're very unique buildings for Phoenix even. They're the only three-story buildings north of Camelback on the Camelback corridor that are mid-century office buildings, and particularly the 444 building, which is a form of architecture called Googie style, which was usually reserved for banks and roadside architecture, mostly restaurants.
The Arrive Hotel will have 79 rooms. Most will have private balconies. There'll be a rooftop bar and local coffee bar. The outdoor pool will be shaded so you can actually swim during the summer without getting scalded. The hotel will be next door to the Newton. That's another adaptive reuse project Perez and his partner worked on.
To complete the hotel project, they need to buy a little land from the city as well, right?
Yeah, they bought a remnant parcel the city acquired but never used for light rail. So in exchange, they committed to creating a public benefit. That means we should see shaded walkways and public art. Perez grew up in Central Phoenix, actually in the Avenues just off Camelback, and he calls these projects labors of love.
They require a lot of time. People are like, "Oh, it's sure taking you a while to get that project done." But if you really went through it, I mean, several times as we do projects, I constantly ask myself, "Why do we do this?" But then I go to the projects and see how people engage with it when they're done, and they're really special places. So it is worth it. It's important.
So what's most challenging when they take on these adaptive reuse projects?
Well, it sounds like a little bit of everything. You're talking about older buildings that have to be upgraded to meet current codes while also preserving their character. Perez says they try to budget for the unknown, but it just never seems like it's enough. There's a shortage of construction workers and materials cost more, so that's another challenge. And there's another aspect that requires a lot of time, working with the community. Perez says neighbors have valid concerns, especially when it comes to parking and traffic, and they try to do a lot of outreach and try to be sensitive to how their projects impact neighborhoods.
Perez and his business partner launched Venue Projects in 2008. They've no doubt seen the market change in the time in between. Does anything in particular stand out?
Well, one big change is acceptance. When Perez and John Kitchell started working on adaptive reuse projects, it was more of a novelty. Not a lot of people, especially during the recession, saying, "Hey, let's spend a lot of money to turn this old building into something cool." Perez used the Newton project as an example of how the industry has changed. They took the former Beefeater's restaurant, saved the fireplaces, some of the original wood and other features, and they built a space that includes Southern Rail Restaurant, Changing Hands Bookstore, and the Southwest Gardener. But 6 years ago, when Venue Projects was shopping around for loans, well, the banks were comparing construction costs for the Newton project to something like a dollar store, which they found insulting.
Nowadays, I love seeing so many people doing reuse stuff. There is actually a market that they can measure and monitor, and now we're getting bumps up for being differentiated instead of penalized.
And there's another payoff when it comes to tenants. He says people want to rent their spaces because they consider them special.
So when will the Arrive Hotel open?
Well, the plan is this fall.
Okay, that's KJZZ's Christina Estes keeping us up to date on the adaptive reuse project happening at Camelback Road and 4th Avenue in Phoenix. And I know I've seen it there, so glad to know. Thanks, Christina. Have a good one.
You're welcome.
Okay, Lauren, that is, of course, the Jeopardy theme music, and some of us entering middle age watch the program quite a bit. In case you missed it, one contestant has been dominating opponents for weeks, raking in the dough. His name is James Holzhauer. He's a professional sports gambler. He got the right answer when he dinged in 97% of the time and averaged a stunning $77,000 an episode. He is also the second contestant to rack up more than $1 million in winnings in regular games, but then...
Spoiler alert! Okay, so footage of the game was leaked in some cities ahead of the episodes airing on Monday. And, shockingly, Holzhauer lost to Emma Betcher, a librarian from Chicago. The footage has been removed from most places online, but Top Sports Plays on YouTube captured the moment via a handheld camera. And this is a spoiler, too. This sound is a bit hard to hear.
Over to James now. He had 23,400, and his response was correct. His wager, a modest one for the first time. That takes him to 24,799. So, Emma, it's up to you. If you came up with a correct response, you're going to be the new Jeopardy champion. Did you? You did. What did you wager? Oh, gosh. 20,000. What a payday.
Now, when asked about his loss, Holzhauer told the New York Times, quote, "Nobody likes to lose, but I'm very proud of how I did, and I really exceeded my own expectations for the show, so I don't feel bad about it."
Even though Holzhauer lost, his achievement is going to be tough to beat. Combined with his $2,000 for coming in second place, Holzhauer's total winnings on the show are, get this, $2,464,216. But that still leaves him number two to the all-time winner, Ken Jennings.
Okay, Lauren, my answer is, what is a comfy lifestyle?
Well, that's clever.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.